Welcome to the second series of the News Club podcast, where we talk about the news and, more importantly, what we can do about it. This season, we're speaking with people, the Rebel Citizens, who aren't just talking about the headlines, but actively working to rewrite what comes next. I'm your host, Em, and today I'm with Debs, my wonderful co-host, who's made many an appearance on this podcast. So yes, go check out that first series to hear from our in-house media expert, or at least one of them. And also joining us is our episode exclusive guest, Dr. Courtney Raj. So who are you? Who are you, Dr. Courtney Raj? Well, from what I understand, you are a journalist, scholar, and director of the Center for Journalism and Liberty at the Open Markets Institute. They are a policy and advocacy organization of experts who use research, journalism, and legal action to challenge monopoly power, especially in big tech, and they promote open competitive markets that strengthen democracy, equity, and innovation. As for you, Courtney, you lead cutting-edge research on AI, media market structures, information power, and policy solutions that protect democracy, independent media, human rights and human liberty, all things we deeply care here at News Club. Thank you so much for joining us. We're very excited to hear your specialist insight on what is happening in the world of big tech regulation, where these efforts are taking place, and how we build a more just and democratic future. Now, to our listeners, I know I just said regulation, but don't leave yet. If you're anything like me, I'm sure that upon first impression, you aren't all too interested in regulation. But if you're also anything like me, I'm guessing that democracy is something that you do care about. It's why I'm the one who's hosting a podcast rather than doing that bit of the work. However, as it turns out, regulation, pretty important. Well, pretty important if we want to be transforming the media landscape. And if there's anything that we are definitely advocating for here, it is an independent, accountable, and democratic media landscape. So for more on how we, and by we, I mean you, can make that happen, go check out the Media Revolution website. They've got a page dedicated to news clubs, how to set them up. Also, following this episode, definitely explore what the Open Markets Institute has to share on their website. There's so much to read and learn, and while we can't cover it all here, I encourage you to use their publications as inspiration for topics, ideas, and conversation starters at your own news clubs, which I hope you've set up by now. So yeah, again, see Media Revolution for any support on that. And as always, subscribe to our newsletter if you haven't already. All links are in the podcast description and on our socials at newsclubuk_. Okay, with all of that out of the way, back to the episode. So, Courtney, the question I'm asking everyone is, what should be headline news but isn't?
Well, there is a lot that should be headline news, but if we drill into kind of the intersection of AI and what it means for the future of media, for news, for journalism, I think there are a couple of things. First is, we keep hearing about the need for innovation, this framing around the race with China, about the need for, you know, AI development, and God forbid we should have any regulations impeding AI innovation. But do we ever hear about what are we innovating towards? Are we innovating towards a more rights-respecting, environmentally sustainable future? Or are we innovating so that billionaires can earn more money, so that a handful of big tech platforms located in Silicon Valley can determine the future for us and our children? Are we innovating so that we can compete with China to create more surveillance, more monitoring? I think that really should be more centered in the news coverage. So it's not so much a story that is missing, but it is a perspective that is missing from a lot of the coverage about AI. Similarly, we hear far too often from a handful of big tech bros, right? The Silicon Valley broligarchy, as we call them. And I think that's problematic because, in fact, there are thousands of AI startups. And if anything, you know, virtually every company is becoming an AI company. But of course, there are a handful that are leading those efforts, in part because they are based in the United States, which, despite the democratic decline here, remains a leader in the world and an economic powerhouse, again, despite a lot of the negative trends. And that's very coercive. We don't hear a lot about the alternative visions for artificial intelligence and for journalism, for news, whether that comes from researchers who have been kicked out of, fired from these big tech companies, or whether we hear from those who are in other countries, the global majority. One story that really stuck out to me recently that I read in Karen Howe's new book, Empire of AI, was about the fight in Uruguay, where they actually have a human right that protects their right to water, and what that means with the intersection of AI. So we hear a bit more, you know, we hear a bit about AI data centers. We do hear about the environmental impacts, but I think we need to hear a lot more about that. And again, that should be integrated into the coverage. It's really about expanding and problematizing a lot of the coverage of AI because there are so many developments in that realm. And I guess just the last thing would be, we should hear a lot more about what's happening with lawsuits with respect to intellectual property and copyright and AI development. So we hear a lot about the New York Times and OpenAI lawsuit, but we have heard, for example, very little about the class action lawsuit filed in California against AI companies for the theft of everyone's data. We should hear more about what's happening in other countries that are trying to re-exert their rights and about the way that US trade policy is being weaponized in order to restrict the ability of other countries to regulate their own economies, to regulate AI, and to ensure sustainable news ecosystems.
Awesome. That was the best answer we've got. Thank you so much. Debs, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, absolutely. Everything you've said. And I think there's, you know, what we're seeing is obviously AI has been something like this field has been around for a long time, but it's really come into the news cycle in a very new way in the last couple of years. And so you're seeing a lot of new language being introduced to the public. And it's arguable that, for example, the term artificial intelligence itself is a kind of PR move. And certainly artificial general intelligence, this, you know, you're saying, what is it that we're developing towards? Well, they keep saying it's towards AGI, artificial general intelligence. But exactly what Karen Howe talks about in her book is that they don't have a definition of intelligence. They don't actually have a, you know, and actually when you start drilling down into it and you start looking at, you know, she reproduces some internal communications. And when they actually try and define intelligence, it is hugely like ableist, racist, sexist, like it's basing intelligence on a really, really narrow idea. For example, she reproduces some messages where people are debating whether or not blind people are less intelligent than people that can see, and therefore whether it's important for an AI to be able to see, quote unquote, in order to be able to achieve AGI. I mean, this is nonsense. This is a nonsense way to think about intelligence. And when you actually unpack that stuff, it's really clear that then you're like, well, you're saying AGI is your North Star, but where is it? What is it? So yeah, I think even just challenging some of that language and being like, we shouldn't, I mean, Courtney, do you have a suggestion? Is there something else we should be calling it other than AI?
Yes. So first of all, artificial intelligence means everything and nothing, right? It is such an ambiguous and, as you said, PR-centric word. So on one hand, what we're talking about now since the launch of ChatGPT with the large language models, the multimodal models, the hyperscalers, AGI, this is really around generative artificial intelligence. And that is the development that has really shifted the debate and I think created a lot of new challenges, emphasized the need for regulation. We have had artificial intelligence of various sorts, which you could really call machine learning. I think, for example, a lot of the discussions and debates around content moderation had to do with the deployment of different types of AI systems, right? But that's not what we're talking about. We're not talking about necessarily like recommender system or autofill completion systems. So I think it is important when we're talking about generative AI, which is, you know, the ability to create content, do massive amounts of data processing, discover trends and insights from big troves of content and data. You know, that is something that has made, you know, enormous strides recently. I think the intelligence aspect is not helpful because in part it forces us, and it's helpful for them to focus on this issue of, well, what is intelligence? What is artificial general intelligence? Frontier models, all of these ideas that distract attention from real world impacts now in our lives that we actually are seeing now, whether we're talking about discrimination, whether we're talking about environmental impacts, whether we're talking about the labor replacement impact of these technologies. You know, there are so many impacts that we're seeing now. And one of the things that really concerns me around the discussion of AGI and this, you know, so-called North Star is this idea that somehow AI is going to take over or become weaponized or replace humans or whatever the issues are without the agency of humans. So AI does not exist out in the wild without you know, the computers and the electrical systems and the wires, and then all of the political and economic choices that we make about how, where, and when to deploy AI systems. So, you know, AI is only going to take over and, you know, create bioweapons if it is, you know, used by humans to do that, or we create robots that are able to do that. So there's this discrepancy between this ideal of what AGI can do as if it has independent agency. I think another term that is very concerning and which I really wish journalists would not use without a caveat or, you know, a subclause, which is hallucinations. So, you know, it's kind of like using collateral damage instead of, you know, murder or killing in the context of war, right? I'm thinking of like, let's just think of like the Iraq war, right? We talked a lot about collateral damage as if the people being killed were not also humans and also people with families, et cetera. So we talk about hallucinations. What are hallucinations? They're errors, right? What is generative artificial intelligence? To some extent, it is a combination of data, really advanced math, a lot of compute power, and prediction. So when we get an inaccurate answer to something, that is an error. It's not a hallucination, right? When a chatbot or an AI summary makes up citations to, you know, law suits that don't exist, or, you know, cases that don't exist, or facts that don't exist, that's not a hallucination. That's an error. But we have adopted the obfuscating terminology of the industry. And that makes it really hard for us to deal with it, because if we could talk about errors and error rates the way we did, for example, with content moderation or with, you know, decision-making machine learning algorithms, then we could have a better policy discussion. We could have more effective regulations, well, at least in some respect, because we could talk about, you know, what is the acceptable error rate for releasing a chatbot into the wild. Well, that's also going to differ from the acceptable error rate of self-driving vehicles, right? Those are all using AI, and we're willing to accept a certain amount of error in, you know, depending on what sector we're in. And, you know, you kind of opened the episode around, you know, talking about regulation, and it's a word that I think people fall asleep at or think is inherently negative. But I want you to think about, you know, right now, I'm, you know, drinking a sparkling water. I want to know that that was produced in a safe facility where I don't have to worry that, you know, there's poison in it. I'm using computers and the internet right now. I want to know that there are regulations preventing people from spying on me, or, you know, whatever. There's lots of regulations that are designed to keep us safe, that are designed to balance individual or corporate interests with the public interest, or, you know, in, for example, environmental interests, or in the case of news, with the information ecosystem, right? And so I think there's a lot about the terminology that makes it really hard for us to have good conversations. And there is such an American antipathy towards the concept of regulation, which we've certainly exported, and maybe that's also native to the UK. I'm not sure, but, you know, I've lived in Europe and the Middle East. Europe has, I think, a different perspective on regulation. They have an idea that we need to regulate markets, we need to regulate the rules of the road in order to steer where we want, for example, innovation to head, right? In the Middle East, regulation has a very different perspective because governments, for the most part, there are more authoritarian. There is less of a concept of public interest that is inclusive, et cetera. So, you know, I think we have to get away from this idea that regulations are bad. We want to know that, you know, the elevator taking us up to 27th floor is regulated, that someone is, you know, put in place requirements for that building, for that elevator, for oversight, et cetera. When I lived in Dubai, I had zero interest in going up into the Burj Dubai or the Burj Al Arab because I saw how people were treated. The laborers worked under extreme conditions. And I actually got fired and kicked out of the country for an article I wrote about that had to do with kind of regulatory oversight of the airline industry. So regulations are our friends, and especially when it's coming to something like artificial intelligence and, you know, whatever that means, essentially what we're talking about is regulating what companies, corporations are allowed to produce and put into the world, how they are allowed to produce and create that information. One thing we rarely talk about with respect to AI and regulation is kind of not looking so much downstream, but looking upstream. What are the implications of enabling the datafication of every aspect of our lives? You know, one of the concerns, for example, around making, say, more equitable or more inclusive AI could be that it encourages monitoring and surveillance of more and more of our daily lives, our inner lives, of marginalized populations, of at-risk populations, et cetera. And so we have to be really thoughtful and think about what type of society, economy are we creating, and use regulations to shape that path.
Could not agree more. And you reminds me also of Media Revolution, who we kind of do a bit of news club things with. And they talk about this. They, you know, they talk about the need for regulation, for replacing, for resisting, for radicalizing, and like kind of seeing in terms of like the broad spectrum, seeing the importance of approaching any and everything really holistically, and understanding that there are different parts of the work, and like you can involve yourself with different elements, and like how vital each aspect is to then support the other, and to then find ourselves in a place where we can really, like, as you say, like steer this towards a path that we actually want to be going in. One of the episodes we did was with Lou Miller, and they kind of talk a lot about this and this idea of like, it's not so much about, you know, whether you're against or for AI. It's very much like, how are we going to use this tool? Be that like a fork, be that like, you know, like we use anything. And I think understanding that that's more important than just saying whether it's good or bad or this, the other, you know, moralizing it in a way that's really unhelpful. But kind of going into a bit of what, like, I want to say passion that I'm hearing from you, like what motivates you? Why is it that you do this aspect of the work?
So what first motivated me to get into this was I worked for an organization that protects journalists, and was, as I mentioned, I got fired and kicked out of a country for writing about basically about safety problems on the national airline. And I ended up getting into press freedom advocacy. And so for many years, I worked to protect and defend journalists who were under threat around the world, who were thrown in jail, who were killed, and who were, you know, trying to do journalism in really challenging conditions, and often depending on platforms, you know, like Facebook or YouTube or Twitter or other major global platforms to bypass censorship, bypass state-owned media, and communicate. And I actually did my doctoral research in Egypt in the lead up to the Arab Spring, and saw just how impactful and incredible ability to express oneself and to report on what they're seeing, what was happening on the ground with police violence, with sexual harassment, and with these issues that were never covered in the media, how important that was. But as I spent years doing this work and begging platforms to, you know, verify accounts of groups like Raqqa as being slaughtered silently because ISIS was spoofing them, and you could literally put your life at risk if you got into touch with the wrong account. Begging platforms to put back up content from independent news sites that was taken down by government requests because they didn't want that problematic coverage of their corruption. Begging platforms to make their rules more transparent, to respect our privacy, all of this. I was so far down the problem chain, and I wanted to do something more impactful. And I started to investigate more deeply some of the questions during a postdoc. And at that time, there were all these, this new regulatory wave around the world, starting from Australia, to compel tech platforms to share the value that's created by the presence of news on their platform. So essentially making big tech pay for the news they use, right? I mean, how useful would Google be if it didn't have any news links? You know, a lot of social media is discussing things that are in the news that some, you know, journalist wrote about or discovered. And that I then realized, you know, these platforms are so powerful. They're so wealthy. They had such close connections with the US government that they were impervious to regulation in any other country, and that fundamentally the problem is monopoly. It's this concentration of power in a handful of very, very wealthy and very powerful companies that literally control many of the spaces where we express ourselves, right? Their algorithms not only determine visibility and viability for news organizations that are on them, but they, you know, we know from research, for example, that YouTube algorithms cultivate extremism and polarization. We saw it was part of the Global Internet Forum for Counterterrorism, one of their international advisory committee members, because these platforms have become places where terrorists and extremists and hateful people, harassers, put out all of this information and all of this content. And then the platforms aggregate that. They amplify that, they connect people. You know, why do we see the rise of so many, you know, kind of fringe movements, whether we're talking about flat earthers or anti-vaxxers or conspiracy theorists? Well, now they're all connected. Now they're all, you know, able, they're being fed content and all of this that is really creating a very dangerous, problematic, harmful social fabric that we have no control over. Because in this country, going back to regulation, we have an allergy to the idea of regulating anything that seems to touch on speech. And we've decided to regulate corporate platforms as like superhumans. So they have actually what are human rights of free speech, apparently freedom of religion, all of these rights that are protected in our Constitution, as well as the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in some cases. And they don't die. And they have major exemptions from liability. So they have all, and they don't have to abide by copyright, except for like major artists that have the backing of other big companies in the recording studios or, you know, the big Hollywood studios. So their power is really incredible. And then I saw with the Trump election most recently that they are wielding this power to favor certain political parties and candidates. And we saw that in the UK. We saw that in Germany. And that is in part because we don't have any regulations. And so, you know, I felt like working on issues of concentration of power, of monopoly, and reclaiming human agency, human control over these giant tech corporations was the most impactful thing I could do with my expertise, with my network, and to really bring about the change and the evolution that I want to see, and that, you know, those who I've worked with around the world also want to see, where they have, you know, they have autonomy and agency, and, you know, they aren't beholden to algorithms. And, you know, to bring it to the news and journalism, like I did this big study a couple years ago where I interviewed hundreds of journalists in countries that were either experiencing conflict or, you know, under pressure. And all of these journalists and media organizations told me about how difficult it is to do journalism, trying to figure out what are the rules of the platform, what's the algorithm going to do, having to play to the algorithm. And then because of the flood of disinformation and propaganda and falsehoods on these platforms, they essentially became the janitors of the internet, cleaning up the crap flowing on these platforms, fact-checking ridiculous things instead of doing journalism, accountability journalism, instead of serving their communities. So there's just like, so it was so many issues. And, you know, I had been writing about AI for several years, including AI and disinformation a couple years before ChatGPT came out, and the risks of deep fakes, the risks of weaponized propaganda. And so, you know, with AI, generative AI coming out, it just felt like we only have a short window of time to exert control. And I wanted to be there at the forefront trying to do so.
That's awesome. That's really cool. That's really, really cool. I'm curious to know how this also relates to like the work that we're doing and that you're doing, Debs, as well.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the UK passed a piece of legislation a year ago, which was kind of building on what happened in Australia in terms of trying to create a more level playing field between the big tech monopolies and everyone who is dependent on them. I mean, you know, because of the political context that we have, I mean, it's all framed around markets and around markets functioning well. It's not actually framed around the public good. But we're, you know, I'm helping convene some independent publishers, you know, hopefully it will be a group of about 300, 400 independent publishers, all trying to then negotiate with Google and get some money out of Google. Google's the first big monopoly that's going to be designated as having this monopoly. And then any company that depends on it will be able to go to Google, try and negotiate what they think is a fair settlement. And then what the legislation provides is if they don't feel that they've been treated well, then there's a backstop, and then the government will step in and say, oh, do we think that this negotiation has been treated fairly and could ensure some kind of fair dealing? But you wanted to say something?
Yeah, I mean, just a couple of things, because I'm very familiar with what's happening in the UK with the strategic market designation of Google. And just to be clear, like, we say Google, but actually they're just talking about Google search, right? So that's only one product line of many. And oddly, as far as I'm aware, it doesn't include YouTube, which is the world's second largest search engine, which is also owned by Google. So one thing, I mean, I will say my background is more in journalism and human rights. The reason I got into competition policy is because we lacked, I think, effective hard instruments and hard law to impose obligations on tech companies that will enable human rights. I mean, especially now, I mean, human rights are norms and we are in an era of normative breakdown. So competition policy is not perfect, but I think it was a good evolution in this debate from going from like, hey, why don't you self-regulate? Let's create a code of practice. It's like, no, let's look at our laws, our antitrust laws, and apply them and require that you abide by them. But there's still a lot of shortcomings with that. A, the idea of a market. The problem is these are, you know, Hydra-headed companies that are across markets and in the digital economy, and now particularly in the generative AI inflected economy, you know, you can't necessarily only look at a market because, you know, Google search dominance is fueling its AI dominance. It's all about data, right? And all of its products are intertwined. And so I think that's a challenge. Similarly, I work with a lot of publishers. I advise a lot of publishing groups about how to do collective action, about how to create collectives, et cetera. What should they be doing in the AI era, previously around platform remuneration? One of the problems is that even if you get every publisher in the world together, they still do not come close to the size and wealth of the major tech platforms of big tech, right? So there's always going to be some discrepancy in bargaining power. Furthermore, for bargaining to work, for negotiations to work, you need information. But publishers have very little information that they need in order to establish value. I'm also concerned because the initial way that countries have been approaching this platform remuneration for journalism question was really Google and Meta, Google search, Meta, Facebook, maybe Instagram, not WhatsApp, not YouTube, not all these other platforms that news organizations are also using, and not addressing AI for the most part. That's starting to change. But even then, this concept of how do we determine value is really problematic because the tech platforms have convinced a lot of people, including policymakers, that we should just look at value kind of based on referral traffic and the value that creates and the advertising that's generated. Sure, that is definitely an important aspect. But if you think about a colleague of mine likes to use this analogy where if you have a top floor apartment in New York City and you buy your neighbor's apartment for $2 million and you combine those, the value created is far more than just those two apartments together. It's more than $4 million. It's probably $10 million because you've got a 10,000 square foot apartment. So we have to rethink about what we actually mean when we're looking at the value created. And we must get away from this narrow conception of value as being just around referral traffic or advertising revenue. There is value to platforms being, you know, full of accurate relevant, you know, information, of quality information. And we can see that now with, you know, the what Cory Doctorow calls the enshittification of the internet, right? There's all this crud out there. And so people actually want better information. And there is a company in Switzerland that started doing behavioral studies to look at how do people use platforms, just looking at their use, behavioral study to see how do they use Google search, for example, with news results, with news in the results and without news in the results. And we're not talking about people looking for news. If you're a new mom or dad and you have a baby, you're searching which formula to use, don't you want the news about the recall of that baby formula or the whatever, corruption investigation into that corporate leader? Yes, right? It's not just about people searching for news. News is part of our daily life. It's part of everything we experience. So when they did this study, they found that people actually behave differently without news in the results. They ended up going more directly to news organizations because they were seeking information and they felt that they weren't getting a good enough picture. So they've now replicated that study in Poland, in Germany, I think in the UK, and they extrapolated based on the behavior change and then what that would translate into essentially advertising revenue based on that particular market. My colleague Anya Shiffrin and her economist co-author Harris Matten wrote about what would that mean in the US, and it was billions of dollars that would be owed to news publishers. And yet all of the discussions everywhere in the world around how much platforms should be sharing in the value created jointly between the referral traffic they generate and the advertising revenue generated, it's only in the hundreds of millions.
I'm really curious to know what it looks like in the efforts that's being made currently, actually, Debs, as well. Like, do you find yourself in a position where you can collectively bargain for something that is meeting, as you say, Courtney, like the level of value that is actually being produced?
I mean, we're in the process at the moment of doing a survey with publishers, and which is exactly trying to bridge some of that information gap and come up with a model and evaluation that says, you know, what do we think the overall value of news within the UK is to Google? And then what do we think the particular value of these publishers is? And then also showing the dependence of the publishers on the Google ecosystem, because that's part of what you're then using to demonstrate the unfair and bargaining positions between Google and the publishers. And part of what we're trying to show with it, and obviously we need the data to show it, but I expect this to be true, because this is a set of publishers who are mostly, they're all independent publishers, they will all be serving kind of specific audiences, whether that's geographical or communities of interest, and they're all producing novel content. They're producing, you know, they're not just taking things from news wires, and they'll often be serving communities that are not really being served by other sources. So what we're trying to show is that those pieces of information, those pieces of content have more value than just the kind of generic content being produced by these like bigger conglomerates. And in fact, you know, we can draw on some of the arguments that Google itself has made, because when Google has been trying to fight off these efforts in other places, for example, in South Africa, they're considering regulation. And in Google's presentations, they were saying, well, you can't just take a kind of this is what the South African news market looks like, and these people have got this amount of share of the market, so they're generating the same, you know, they've got 60% of the market, so they're generating 60% of the value. And Google itself said, well, probably they're not generating 60% of the value. Probably they're generating less value than that. And the kind of smaller niche minority things producing content in specific languages, whatever, are producing things which are particularly novel and of particularly high value, especially at crucial moments. So one of the things that we're sort of asking publishers to say as well is, have there been particular times when a story of yours has really taken off? And when has that, you know, we expect to hear stories back from publishers, for example, about particular moments in the pandemic, when maybe they were the only publisher that was giving like up-to-date information about what COVID restrictions were in that particular area. And that was the only place that you could go to for it. And this is particularly important in the context of AI, because of course, if AI is drawing from the whole of the web and is trying to ask answer a specific query, but the vast majority of what it's seeing from the big publishers is identical, and then the one piece from this independent publisher is actually unique, it's getting more value from that one piece than it is from all of the others.
Maybe. I mean, I think that's one way to look at it. And I do think that there is a lot of value to the uniqueness. And certainly in my interviews, I speak with a lot of AI licensing startups, you know, about the value of news and how they're thinking about that. And I think that is true. I also think that it should be more valuable for these companies also when there is a kind of concurrence around what is in the news. So even if there's a lot of repetition, why? You know, they will say, well, that's not unique and you didn't do anything. But if you see a lot of news publishers publishing the same information, that is a sign, that is a signal that it's probably accurate and reliable, right? That's a good signal. And that could become even more important as the open web, again, becomes full of, you know, synthetic content. We know, for example, that the preponderance of Russian propaganda online through, you know, its billion-dollar budgeted internet research agency and RT and all of these other, you know, hundreds of media organizations that have been churning out propaganda and, you know, Russian content on social media platforms and the web, that gets ingested into these training, both the training models, but also the inference, the what's called retrieval augmented generation, going out to find more recent information to answer questions. And there have been studies by NewsGuard, for example, and others that have shown how chatbots and AI summaries are regurgitating Russian propaganda. So I actually think that we shouldn't cede to the tech platforms the idea that simply because there's a lot of the same piece of news that is not valuable. I think we need to hold two things to be true at once. The unique, local, specific, you know, community-oriented, whatever news is very valuable, and having that consensus from a bunch of news organizations about this news is also valuable. These two things need to be true. And I think one of the biggest problems in this whole debate about, you know, platform regulation and news is they've done such a great job of pitting the small publishers against the big ones, right? But ultimately, we're all in the same basket. You know, if you take a step up, right? We live in a news ecosystem, local news, regional news, national news, global news, trade news, all of this, we need all of that. And so we really need solutions and public policies that recognize that and value all of that so that we're not only favoring one over the other.
Yeah. And I think that also comes to this thing that, you know, regulation, both of the AI companies, but also the need for good regulation of news publishers. And actually, if you have publishers who can show, yeah, I suppose the other element of it is it's not just novelty, but it's novelty, trying to show it's novelty in a positive direction rather than novelty because this is like the Nazi perspective. Actually being able to say these are all publishers who meet certain criteria, who are following standards codes, who have complaints processes, who, you know, that is, yeah, I totally agree. It's not about pitting big against small, but it is about saying, actually, these are some baseline standards that everyone in this basket follows and adheres to. And that is why this is of more value to the AI companies or to Google rather than, yeah, I mean, as we've just seen with the Online Safety Act that's been passed in the UK, I mean, the definition of a news publisher within that is really poor. Like, it does not actually do the job of saying, like, that we've already seen people like Tommy Robinson claiming journalistic status as a way of trying to avoid being able to privilege his own speech. And we know that far right sites do that and will say, oh, we're a news publisher and therefore we should be exempt from certain regulations, whatever. And the Online Safety Act really lays itself open to that. And it's really frustrating because in the UK, we do have Impress. We do have an independent regulator for news publishers. And they could just have written that in. They could have just said, you need to be independently regulated. You know, it doesn't have to be by Impress, but by a regulator that meets the standards set out by the Leveson Inquiry all of those years ago in the context of the hacking scandal. And they chose not to do that. And they've left themselves actually with a real quagmire that you know, at the moment, we're, the focus around the Online Safety Act is really around age verification and, you know, all of the problems of that in terms of privacy and censorship. But we are going to see this problem really emerging of, like, actually people circumventing those restrictions because they're claiming to be a news publisher, even though, because the designation is really weak.
I really want to dig into the regulation aspect of this. Is that okay? It would be really wonderful to hear more on these two main things, which is what is happening and where in terms of regulation efforts. I know, Debs, you wanted to hear about what initiatives are emerging from the Global South, especially. So, Courtney, what can you share about the current state of regulating big tech on the global scale?
Yeah, sure. So specifically with platforms in the press, I'd definitely direct you to our website. We have a global tracker of media and tech regulation where we are looking at the developments everywhere. And you mentioned South Africa earlier, testified, I don't know, like three or four times before them, submitted several, several inputs to their inquiry because they're really focused on, you know, how can they get this right? How can they build on what else has been done around the world? And they're taking an approach that, you know, Debs alluded to not being taken in the UK, which is to designate, you know, the fairly independent regulator. If you're membership, then you would be covered by this law. Now, that's interesting because on the one hand, I'm concerned when any one institution is granted the right to decide who is and who isn't a news publisher. And that's really a core of all of these regulations. In Canada, for example, it was a little bit easier because they already had a bunch of public policies, including tax policies, where they had to define news organizations. And so they had already gone through that, which I think kind of depoliticized it a bit. I mean, it was still very political, but that became, I think, a little bit less of an issue. But it's always an issue about who decides who gets to, say, benefit from this regulation. In my opinion, we should be looking for multiple indications. So multiple entities, for example, you mentioned Impress in the UK. You could also look at, you know, INMA or at, you know, the News Media Association or kind of any established, you know, well-respected body. You could also look at external indicators like the Journalism Trust Initiative or, you know, other kind of external benchmarks where you would basically agree to adhere to basic journalistic standards, you know, transparency of your editorial process and who's on your editorial team, independent corrections policy, all these sort of things. So we're seeing that show up in all of these regulatory discussions. New Zealand has also been exploring how they could adopt similar regulations, and we're seeing them seek to include AI uses because, of course, we don't want to only create regulations that address last year's or, you know, last decade's problems. Indonesia had a presidential decree, which is definitely not the ideal way to create, you know, these types of regulations. It's much better to have a, you know, a regulatory, an independent regulatory process or a legislative process, but there was a presidential decree there. There is Brazil has been looking at adopting. India as well has been having a competition inquiry and considering this type of legislation. I think it's very challenging right now because you have massive lobbying budgets and efforts by Google and Meta to tank these efforts. And of course, we had some efforts here in the US which have failed. So California got very close until it was vetoed by Governor Newsom and essentially a gift to the tech companies with some other idea of like Google donating some money to a fund. But guess what? That money doesn't exist and the institution that was to manage that fund doesn't want to do it. So there's a lot of learning. What I found very interesting about these regulatory efforts is that there was a lot of interest from lawmakers in understanding what has been done elsewhere, what worked, what didn't, how to improve it. And I mean, that's one of the reasons that we created this global tracker is to try to bring that research together. I think absolutely regulation is going to have to include the use of news, at least if not for training right now, because to some extent that train has left the station and may need to be addressed through copyright claims, but for sure for inference, for sure for the use of news content to fuel their chatbot answers, their AI summaries. Again, it's just not useful. If you remember, when ChatGPT first came out, it couldn't answer any questions from before 2023, right? Why was that? That was because we did not have that process yet called Retrieval Augmented Generation, RAG, where essentially, to simplify things grossly, basically you have a relatively static model, underlying model, large language model, and then you have a RAG that goes out and looks on the internet to find more recent, relevant, timely information to answer and address your query. So that's very clearly should be compensated, right? Your chatbot is going to be useless if it can't answer questions that people are searching for. And again, I think that goes to your point earlier, Debs, about the value of local news or unique news. And part of what we need to think about when we think about value is that you don't actually know when that query for something unique is going to happen. So there's, I would argue, a value in simply having potential access to news, even if that never gets a hit, because you never know when that information is going to be needed. I don't see anyone taking me up on that idea, but I still think it's worth putting it out there.
Absolutely. And also, because you've mentioned quite a few things there, what would you say are the top three examples of like the strongest efforts to rein in big tech happening right now?
Well, I think Brazil stands out in part because when it was the only country when it went up against Twitter or X and Elon Musk didn't back down. Right. So it actually blocked X when it failed to comply with local law. Now, as a human rights activist that has brought concerns in other places like India and Turkey, where they have blocked platform access for not complying with laws, but those are not countries where you have democratically enacted legislation. In Brazil, you had, you know, democratically enacted legislation, you had a judicial decision, he didn't comply. And so they stood up to that. They are in the process of a pretty comprehensive AI bill there was at one point a separate copyright and AI bill that's now been looped into that. It started as a kind of disinformation bill that has gone away. So they're really trying to figure out how to regulate AI. They have really interesting things, including like what about the rights of dead people? Right? The rights of, you know, how should we think about, you know, your right as a person, you're in this training data, all of these things. So really, really interesting efforts there. And they're a big enough economy that, you know, the tech companies are looking very closely there. There was an effort that, again, got derailed by Google to adopt a similar type of legislation to Australia. They used the front page of Google search to propagandize against it. So if we think about regulations, you could regulate these platforms as neutral intermediaries and, for example, prohibit them from, you know, propagandizing or advertising against regulation they don't like. We saw the same thing with TikTok here in the US, sending messages out to all its users saying, hey, the US wants to get rid of TikTok. You know, I just don't think that should be allowed, right? We also see, I think, in the European Union, I mean, without the EU, we are in dire straits, right? The EU has a set of laws, the Digital Markets Act, the Digital Services Act, the EU AI Act. They are definitely not perfect, but they are certainly better than what exists in most places. And right now I see them really as one of the last bastions, ensuring that we have some level of, you know, autonomy in these systems, some level of oversight. So I think that's really important. I hope that they do not give in to the pressure and threats from the Trump administration related to trade and, you know, visa restrictions if they decide to implement their laws. It's incredible to think that, you know, the US administration is pressuring another democratic entity to not abide by its laws as if that's just an option. And then, you know, I think that UK, I was kind of hopeful for a little while, because there was, you know, the Make It Fair campaign. I think that, you know, after this recognition that we shouldn't just allow big tech companies to run roughshod over our intellectual property rights and destroy the creative communities and the information sector. So Baroness Kitron and then many high profile artists and musicians and all of the newspapers got together around this campaign. It really felt like, you know, we're hearing from people and from, you know, institutions that are affected by this. But then we see the UK government go and, you know, purchase, you know, do procurement from the big tech companies and like use them as their cloud providers. So really, it's a very mixed bag right now. I think that unfortunately, the big tech and US government have been very successful in this narrative around, you know, don't impede AI innovation. You're going to fall behind. You're going to, you know, kill your economy. And so that's making it really hard to see these regulations. And frankly, you know, AI and technology platforms are domestic, but they're also global. And so, you know, national efforts are also going to be limited if they're not also implemented in the home country, in most cases, the US, but also China, right? We didn't even talk about China. That's kind of the other leader in this space. So both contexts have real challenges, and that makes it really hard for other countries to regulate because they just refuse to abide by those regulations, or they're able to like pay off the critics, whether again, the US government with trade or China with, you know, foreign direct investment or, you know, helping build so-called smart cities. I mean, I'm really concerned. I think, you know, again, like a lot of the countries that Karen wrote about in her book around Uruguay and Chile, imperfect, but at least they have a more nuanced view of how to think about the impacts and what we need to regulate for.
Yeah, and you also see regulatory capture, right? You know, in this piece of legislation which we're supposed to be using to get money out of Google is being overseen by the Competition and Markets Authority, and the new head of that is someone that's just come from Amazon. So you're also just going to see the way that these things are interpreted constantly. You know, the fact that they're really, really behind, they're not even including AI mode in what they're designating, which seems complete nonsense. And it's hard to know whether the extent to which they're behind the curve is deliberate or whether it's just, you know, what we've seen throughout all parts of government of like, it's been shrunk down and de-skilled. And then they end up, you know, in order to fill those gaps, they bring in consultants. And where do those consultants come from? They come from the same monopolies that they're supposed to be regulating. So yeah, it definitely feels like a tricky time. But I'm the things that Cloudflare are doing in the States is quite interesting. Of like, this is another big tech corporation, but it actually has the capacity to stop AI crawlers, and it has the capacity, it has a very big information base, has an information base that actually allows them to see things that from the perspective of the publisher you can't see, for example.
And Cloudflare is, I mean, it basically manages 20% of global internet traffic. So yes, it's US based, but it's creating a new status quo, a new default, which is blocking AI crawlers as opposed to allowing them, which is being implemented around the world. So that is really important because in my interview, I wrote a piece about this. I'm happy to again share that with you for your audience. But in my interviews for that, you know, what I heard was that this could have a standard setting impact in terms of other cloud providers defaulting to opt out, offering services like bot tracking and bot blocking, et cetera. But again, this idea that, you know, this giant Silicon Valley tech corporation, or I think they're maybe based in Seattle, is setting the rules of the road when it comes to what you mentioned in the US, which is this pay per crawl idea. I think we should be testing new things, et cetera. But according to what I've gleaned, they're proposing or they're using a 70 split with publishers where they're getting 30% of any revenue generated. Well, that is essentially the same monopoly profits that Google had from digital advertising, the app stores, Apple's monopoly app store, Spotify, you know, this is still not a good split. And so if they set that precedent, is that going to become the precedent for the rest of the industry? You know, there's still a lot of questions. I'm all for the default blocking, but, you know, we shouldn't just welcome it with open arms without also being skeptical and keeping track of, you know, what this is going to mean for publishers and the revenue split.
I'm kind of scared. I'm like, what do we do? Where is our power? I don't know. And I want to hear something hopeful. Can you guys give me something hopeful?
I mean, I'm definitely not the person to come to if you want an optimistic view, because unfortunately, we don't have the unity in publishing that we need. Let me tell you something optimistic. Denmark. So Denmark has created an entity, basically a digital publishing collecting organization that represents like 99% of the publishers. That has allowed them to be much more effective in influencing government policy, in pushing back against expropriation by the big tech companies. So like OpenAI is not allowed to scrape any news organizations there. Like I think they sent police to like Apple headquarters for breaking the law. Like they've just done really interesting things. And now they're a small country and a small language. And so there's, you know, a feeling that they don't necessarily have a lot of power. But for me, when I look at that example, I see the power of collective action. And that's what we need. I think similarly, it's going to be really bad for the open web, but I think all publishers should be blocking AI crawlers from their sites so that we create scarcity and we create a dynamic where you must figure out how to gain access to that information, because they are, you know, a lot of jurisdictions are not going to allow these chatbots to be really bad products, right? There's the EU code on disinformation. There are other legal frameworks that will prevent that. So I think if we can create scarcity, you know, that is the control that publishers and we as individuals have, block those bots. I think we need to see a lot more lawsuits. We need a lot more lawsuits against a lot more of those AI companies. So far, the vast majority of lawsuits are in the United States. There's like one in Canada, there's one in the UK, but we need to see a lot more. That's what happened with Napster, right? We saw the lawsuits. It changed the dynamic. It changed the equation. So we need to, you know, rebalance power. And we can do that if we have more collective action.
Thank you. Yeah, and I think this isn't a like going up against the big tech company as an example, but in Liverpool City Region has a data cooperative and they ran a citizens assembly to create a charter for AI, the ethical use of AI. So that's both a charter for how their data co-op is going to use AI, but it also creates a kind of model that could be adopted by, you know, businesses and community organizations and the local council or whatever. It creates something that has actually come out of a collective process of discussion rather than something that you're saying where you're just, the standards are all being set by the tech companies or being set, you know, by these big monopolies and you're kind of waiting for them to battle it out. Like that's not something that in itself solves any of these problems, but I think it does help bridge some of this problem around the PR problem of regulation, right? That actually, if you're saying this is a collective code, like we've decided together in this place that this is how we want to use this technology, this is how we want to see it develop, then you've got a much stronger case for saying, yeah, we want to hold our boundaries around this and we want to push back on the tech companies around this. It's not just like, yeah, the idea of like, oh, the red tape that is just constraining the innovation coming out of Silicon Valley. It's actually people having a different vision for what they want from technology.
Yeah. And I would just add that even in democratic countries, I mean, it is theoretically, at least, like the expression of the will of the people. Sure, regulation can be red tape, but at the same time, like, you know, in our country, Congress created certain regulatory bodies. They gave them certain powers, and Congress is elected by the people. So we need to see, I am very much in favor of collective opportunities for community-driven bottom-up processes. I also think that we need our leaders to do things in the public interest, because a lot of people are trying to put food on the table, get their kids to school, you know, deal with their personal issues, and they don't have time or inclination. And so we shouldn't also have to devote our time and energy and all of this to regulating these giant corporations. We have elected officials that are supposed to do that. Like we spent our time going to vote and, you know, that's what they should be doing. So I think we need a balance between those two, because, you know, I just think about myself and my colleagues in the digital rights movement, like how much free time we gave to tech companies, you know, to help them develop better policies, to make sure that they were more inclusive, to address content moderation issues, et cetera. All unpaid, uncompensated our labor for free for those companies. So yes to community involvement and bottom up, and yes to democratic regulatory oversight and direction in the public interest.
We want that money, yes.
And they should pay their taxes, right?
Basic shit, absolutely. All right, so for our listeners, on the 20th of September, we'll be hosting the first News Club Live session, which is basically a taster, as it were, for what a news club can be and look like. We've also got workshops that are being led by and hosted by Media Revolution to kind of support you in your creation and setting up of your news clubs. As we say, it's like a book club, but for news. That's it. So in light of this, what would you bring to the online news club, Courtney?
I mean, I would pick any headline from an independent news organization that is writing about AI. I think we could talk about AI data center development in your community. Let's talk about what are the implications of this development. What's it going to cost? Who's getting tax breaks? What are the environmental impacts? What's it mean for your access to fresh water? I think that would be really interesting for a news club because it brings AI from this nebulous, you know, term that means everything and nothing, as we said, to, you know, a very real, instantiated, physical thing. So I think that would be very useful because similarly, we talk about cloud computing, right? I think picking a headline that has to do with something in that domain would be really important, not just a headline, a story. And then thinking about, yeah, talking about what is the government doing? Which cloud services are they using? Where are they building these things? There's a lot that could, I think, generate a lot of interesting discussion. What jobs are being created or lost?
Absolutely. What about you, Debs? What would you bring?
I would bring so many things on this topic. Maybe I would be interested to have something which is doing, because AI mode has been going in the US for a while and it's only just come to the UK. So maybe something
AI
that's
mode?
Talking. So AI mode is basically with Google search at the moment in the UK, the default has got AI overviews at the top, but the search results are underneath. But with AI mode, you stop having any search results at all. It's moving towards what has been called Google Zero, where it's actually not about taking you out of Google and following links. Instead, it's just trying to keep you within their platform. So it'd be good to see some coverage of what that impact of that has been in the US on publishers or on the web in general, because, you know, you're 6 months ahead of us on that or something, so that people actually know what the implications of switching to AI mode is.
Nice. Right. Well, that will be some interesting chats for our news club attendees. Thank you so much, guys. Right. Okay. Last one. What is the one thing everyone should do leading up to 2029? Courtney.
Organize, exist, make sure that you do joyous things that have nothing to do with a smartphone or an internet or a computer. Live in the real world, talk to real people.
Yes, that was the correct answer. Not that there was one, but if there was one, that would be the correct answer. Thank you so much for your time. I've actually, like, this has been really, really insightful. I knew that the series was going to be so fascinating to just have people talk about what they know and what they can really speak on. So thank you so much for your insight. Really, really appreciate it. And absolutely, we'll be having a look definitely at everything you guys are sharing, and definitely please share those links and I will put that on the podcast episode description. Yeah. Thank you to our listeners. Check out our socials, subscribe to the newsletter, listen to past episodes, read stuff and touch grass. So yeah, thank you so much and hopefully catch you soon.
Thank you.